Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For 3 years, journalist Mark Lynas traveled to the far-flung reaches of the globe, Alaska, Mongolia, Peru, the South Pacific Islands, for a singular mission to document stories of the effects of climate change. Snapshots of lives and livelihoods forever changed by rising sea levels, expanding deserts, and vanishing tundras. Tonight on Point, intimate first-hand stories of the impact of global warming from around the world. But first, reaction to the White House release of previously classified documents on the treatment of detainees in the war on terror. The White House says the hundreds of pages show that President Bush did not authorize torture. Critics say the record is still incomplete, especially when it comes to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. John Diamond covers national security for USA Today. I asked him what new information about what the administration knew and did was revealed in these memos.
It tells us that there was a very active, intense internal debate among administration lawyers and policymakers over what to do about extracting valuable intelligence information from suspected terrorist detainees on the one hand versus protecting humanitarian rights of all people in U.S. custody on the other. And the opening premise of the memos emerges from the Defense Department with the view that after 9/11, there was a whole new world in national security. The rules had changed. We were fighting not a country but a group. We were fighting not an army but an ununiformed, amorphous force that didn't recognize conventions and treaties and niceties of prisoner handling. The whole concept of the Geneva Convention, of course, is reciprocity, and the assumption at the get-go from the Pentagon was that there could be no reciprocity with such a group. And then finally, there was the idea that there could very well be an urgent need to get intelligence, such as when is another attack planned, and the idea that the only way to get that intelligence is from another human being. Things like electronic intercepts and spy satellite photos just weren't going to yield that sort of information. So with that as a starting point, administration lawyers looked at the problem and presented the president with option papers essentially saying that you, the president, have all the power to override and supersede treaties, laws, etc., and make your own decisions about prisoner handling. The president essentially agreed with those assessments, but said that in the case of al-Qaeda and Taliban, that even though his view was that the Geneva protections did not apply to them, that they would nevertheless be handled humanely. That was in early 2002, and that's where things stood until later on in the year, when there was renewed concern about attacks, and there was a prisoner named Al-Qahtani at Guantanamo who it was believed had valuable information. This then spurs a whole nother blizzard of memos within the Pentagon over how he and others like him should be handled. And the end result of that in December of 2002 is a memorandum from Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, approving fairly harsh treatment of this type of prisoner.
Just tell us a little bit about how he factored in the debate, and also his role in a process that we've been hearing a lot about called waterboarding.
Yes, the defense secretary is the figure who really spurs the internal debate over the idea that we now have a whole new world, a whole new security threat that needs new paradigms, new concepts, new law even, in terms of dealing with the threat. So he's the spark of all of this internal debate. He gets to the end of 2002 approving a memo that does not, repeat, not approve this waterboarding concept. He rejects that. There's been some reporting to the effect that people at Guantanamo were subjected to this torture in which you're sort of made to believe that you're going to drown. It's a combination of dunking and a wet towel and things of this nature. And this was not approved by the defense secretary, but the use of stress positions, such as making someone stand up under questioning for hours, the use of dogs to intimidate prisoners, this sort of thing was contemplated, was approved by the defense secretary. He then, in January of 2003, after there's some great concerns raised within the Defense Department among military people, JAG officers, and as well as people at Guantanamo, he then revisits the whole issue. He rescinds his December decision and says, all of those things that I said that you could do, you still can do, but only if you come to me, the defense secretary, and ask for permission and give very good reasons. Then, shortly after that, he establishes a very large interagency group to look at the whole issue and come up with recommendations. And it's finally in April of 2003 that a new list comes out with what I would sort of describe as a lesser severity level of handling, in terms of sleep adjustment and the use of incentives and disincentives for prisoners, that sort of thing.
The exhaustive research that you've been doing, John, for USA Today on this particular topic has meant that you've waded through thousands of pages of documents. What you've been able to find, what the administration is now saying about its actions, do they square?
Well, I come away with the feeling that in terms of where the Bush administration placed the highest priority, it was on the idea of we have to get information to protect the nation from attack. That was a higher priority than being completely 100% humane at all times to all people in custody. That comes across very clearly and doesn't really square with the basic message of the president that everyone will be treated humanely. Now, the administration in briefings below the level of statements by the president, I think, acknowledges this, and they view it as a moral position, the idea that look, we are here to protect our country from attack, and sometimes a soft touch just won't work against some of these prisoners. One of the things we got in a White House briefing yesterday was the idea that Al-Qaeda suspects or terror suspects were quite skilled at resisting the sort of less intensive interrogation techniques. They had manuals that were found in Afghanistan talking about how to resist interrogation, and the prisoners at Guantanamo were talking amongst themselves about how to do it. So there was a belief at the Pentagon that the pressure had to be ramped up to get better results. In the end, I'm not convinced that really whatever techniques have been used have actually yielded valuable information. And among professionals who do interrogation, the majority view seems to be that torture, or let's just call it harsh techniques, doesn't generally work.
John Diamond, many thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And John Diamond covers national security for USA Today. He spoke to us from Washington. Now, there may not be day after tomorrow's scale disasters, but unlike the catastrophes in the Hollywood movie, the first-hand accounts in Mark Linus's new book, High Tide, are all true and happening now. For 3 years, Mark Linus traveled the world to Peru, Mongolia, the South Pacific Islands, recording these stories of people living with the consequences of global warming. The signs are striking: rising sea levels, expanding deserts, vanishing tundras. But will political and business leaders respond with the right environmental policies to correct it? Mark Linus says they must. Tonight on Point, intimate first-hand stories about the effects of global warming from around the world. Do you have a global warming story to tell of troubling weather patterns and changing ecosystems? Is the evidence of the impact of global warming becoming too striking for you to ignore, real enough to require change? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from New York is Mark Linus, journalist and author of High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis. Mark, many thanks for being with us. And
it's
I have to say, a disturbing book. Why did you write it? Why did you undertake that 3-year journey? Was it to convince yourself of the immediacy of climate change?
Well, if the truth be told, I was already fairly convinced, but there was the issue of partly convincing others, because of course the debate's been ongoing the whole time about whether or not global warming is real, and I wanted to sort of bring it down to the personal level here, because so much of it's been had at the academic and the scientific level, which wasn't really involving real people, certainly not really involving people at a political level, and so I wanted to actually come back and bring back with me the real stories, which actually made the whole climate change issue come alive and show how it was affecting people, not in the sort of projected futuristic sort of way, but in the real world right now.
So you felt that up until now it's been a rather dry and abstract debate.
Absolutely, and this is what really precipitated my journey. And in fact, ironically, the first location that I visited was my own house in the UK. We had these incredible floods in the year 2000, which we saw unprecedented rainfall. It hadn't rained like that since records began 300 years ago. And when I started talking to the scientists about this, they said to me, yes, this actually is part of a trend. And yes, a warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor. There's scientific evidence that supports the assertion that floods are related to climate change. And so I wanted to also demonstrate that it wasn't something that just happens to people in faraway remote places on the edge of the world like Inner Mongolia or the South Pacific, but it also affects us here in America and also here in Europe.
And of course, those floods in Britain in the year 2000, unprecedented.
Absolutely. There was one particular instance in the little town of Lewes in Kent, East Sussex, where there was a supermarket which actually just caved into the pressure of water and all the stock floated off down the street. There was a guy who was swept into the river. This isn't the sort of thing that you're used to seeing in the British Isles. And I visited one restaurateur in the Welsh borders who had mud halfway up his walls. He'd been flooded out three times that year. And he was telling me that we don't get a winter anymore. We don't get snow and ice and all the usual weather patterns we used to have. What we get now is a wet season. It's almost as if our village has shifted into the tropics and we're getting these tropical downpours and during the winter months. And that was such a striking image to me that I named my chapter title Britain's Wet Season, because this is really just indicative of how radically things are already changing.
So that was the first chapter of your book, Britain's Wet Season. The next one is Baked Alaska. Now tell us about that journey to Alaska and the towns of Fairbanks and Shishmaref. What did you find there?
Well, in Fairbanks, what struck me was that straight away people wanted to talk about the changes in the weather. When we just checked into this little hostel in Fairbanks, the hotel manager came and sort of leaned against the doorway and shifted his cap around and said, "Oh, I'm a hunter and the ducks haven't flown south. They used to fly south in October. Now they're still there in December. The river hasn't frozen. Bears are behaving differently. They don't know whether to hibernate." And so, you know, this was just some of the things that people are talking about. They're talking about also about how the weather's changed and it's warming up. It used to get down to 40 below in the winter months. Now it barely hits 20 below. And you can see the evidence of the changes this has meant right around Fairbanks. If you drive around on the roads there, you're almost in danger of getting seasick because you've got all these strange undulations, which is where the permafrost has started melting out from the ground. And there's also buildings. Something like $35 million is spent every year repairing permafrost damage. So it's becoming a significant issue. And there's all sorts of other places as well where you can see the direct impacts. The glaciers are melting very rapidly across Alaska. And there's one other small Eskimo village I visited on the west coast called Shishmaref, which is being washed away because the sea ice isn't there anymore to protect it from the winter storms. And so you get waves undercutting the fragile island that it's built on.
And how is it affecting the lives of the people who live there?
Well, perhaps the most interesting people to talk to are the native Alaskans, because they live so directly in contact with the earth, and they still also live partly with subsistence lifestyles. And I went to another little interior town, it's only about 400 people live there, called Huslia, and people there live very much off the land. And they took me to see this area, this big grassy plain with just sort of dust around there. All the snow is beginning to thaw off already, and that was apparently a lake. And the people were saying how they used to paddle their canoes across and go and catch salmon from the river, and now they had to carry their boats because the lake water had just disappeared. And again, this seems to be because the frozen ground is thawing and the water just drains away into cracks. And that's just one instance. People's lives are going to change much more radically as the North Polar ice cap melts, as it's predicted to do over the next 50 years or so, which is going to also precipitate most of the polar ecosystem into a state of extinction. Polar bears, walruses, seals, they all need sea ice to live on. And once the sea ice is gone, there's no place for these animals to go, and there's no place for the people who also depend on them.
Okay, Mark, do stay with us. We'll continue your journey around the world to see the first-hand impact on the lives of ordinary people, of global warming and climate change. We're talking tonight about the global effects of climate change with journalist and author Mark Lynas. He travelled around the world for 3 years documenting stories of lives and livelihoods changed because of global warming. What do you hear in the Mark Lynas stories? Evidence of inevitable and irreversible change, or a wake-up call for citizens, politicians and business people to do something to address global warming and the looming crisis ahead? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about global warming with journalist and author Mark Lynas. For 3 years, he travelled to the far-flung reaches of the globe, documenting the effects of climate change. Tonight, he's sharing the stories of what he found from his new book, High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis. What evidence of climate change have you seen in your travels, in your own backyard? Does the world look different from the way it did 10, 20, 30 years ago? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's just bring into the conversation briefly Eric. He's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Eric, you've noticed a change in your own backyard.
Yes, I have. I've been worried about global warming for some time now. And last winter, the President's Day storm, which set snowfall records up and down the East Coast, happened to set the one storm record here in Boston of 27.5 inches. And that led me to do a little bit of research. It turns out that the top 10 snowstorms in Boston history have all occurred since 1958, even though records have been kept since 1892. That doesn't seem like a coincidence, considering that climatologists have been predicting more frequent, more severe weather for years, if not decades.
And do you consider those snowstorms, Eric, as simply an inconvenience? I mean, has it affected the way you actually live your life?
No, it certainly doesn't. But and snowstorms are nothing new for the Northeast, certainly. But they have a cumulative effect. For instance, we had another devastating storm earlier at the beginning of this winter. As a matter of fact, 2 weeks before the start of winter in early December, which just narrowly missed the top 10, being one of the top 10 snowstorms in Boston history. However, that storm ended up costing the state $11.3 million in cleanup alone, which happened to be the most in history, more even than the Blizzard of 78, more than the President's Day storm, and more than, a couple notable storms back in 96 and 93 as well.
So, Mark Lynas, we heard there from Eric about the impact in his backyard, Boston, of the possible effects of global warming. You, on your travels, went to the Pacific Islands and to the Fijian capital of Tuvalu, where I understand you were born. Is that right?
Yes, I was born in Fiji, yes, which is a set of islands in the South Pacific. Actually, my destination was Tuvalu, which is a set of coral atolls, very low-lying coral atolls, which are 1,000 miles north of Fiji. And the capital is Funafuti. There's only 10,000 people that live in the whole of Tuvalu, so it's a very small place. But literally, just the day after I arrived, we spotted these puddles, which suddenly started appearing in roads around the place, even in people's backyards. And really, within about half an hour to an hour, as the tide was rising, these puddles joined up. And actually what was happening was that the islands were actually flooding from the inside out, because as the sea levels rose with the high tide, it drives up the water through the rock itself and actually out. And you get these big lakes. So there was actually one right in front of the Ministry of Environment. There was another right in front of the Meteorological Office. And so people's lives are already being affected. There's fish swimming in these lakes. It's happening much more regularly than it ever used to. It used to happen just 1 month of the year back in the 60s and the 50s, according to people's stories there. Now it happens in December, January, February, March, and even April. So up to 4 or 5 or 6 months of the year now, they're having these high tide events, and it's having a drastic effect on people's lives, even to the extent that the islands themselves are now considering evacuation to New Zealand. So this is probably the first time in recorded history that a nation has had to plan for geographical extinction, never mind political. The people there are going to lose their entire country and their culture and their way of life.
And in one page of your book, you have the local meteorologist, Nelson Rarua, with a poster on the wall of his office saying, "Climate change killing our island softly."
That's right. And it, of course, it's a very slow and long-term process. And the things that people respond to are things which are much more urgent and much more extreme, like a storm coming or food shortages and so on. So it's quite difficult to focus your attention on sort of very long-term changes like this. And of course, what people do worry about is that if you combine a high tide with a severe storm, then there aren't very many places on somewhere like Tuvalu where you can hide. People's traditional way of surviving hurricanes has been to tie themselves to coconut trees. And when you consider that the highest piece of land in the entire island was actually built by a hurricane, you can see quite how on the edge people are living. And one of the things that really struck me was speaking to the first prime minister of Tuvalu, because it's only been independent since 1975. And he's actually in the position of having seen the founding and potentially seeing the end of his nation. And he told me that even though he was urging the young people to go and leave and so that there would still be Tuvaluans living in New Zealand, he himself was planning to stay put, and he himself would go down like the captain of a ship. He would go down with Tuvalu.
Gosh, extraordinary. Let's hear from Kevin in Boston, Massachusetts. And you've got a similar kind of story to tell from your time in Kiribati in the South Pacific.
Yes, Kiribati, yeah. It's actually a set of islands right near Tuvalu, as a matter of fact. And it's very similar. It's great to hear your guest speaking about these islands. They're very low-lying atolls, and you can actually see the coconut trees on the shorelines falling into the ocean. And the old men of the villages would talk about how they can't believe how much smaller, how much farther the tide comes in than it used to, and things like that. So,
Mark Linus, is any kind of provision being made for the people who are going to lose their livelihoods at the very least, and possibly even their lives, should this happen quickly enough in a place like Tuvalu?
Well, at the moment, not really. And as your caller mentioned, this isn't just happening in Tuvalu. It's happening in Kiribati, in the Maldives, the Marshall Islands, all coral atolls, and also in low-lying areas right around the world. So parts of Bangladesh, for example, I think a third of the whole country will go under over the next century, which will displace 50 to 100 million people. So when you start to factor the really big environmental refugee flows that are going to be happening into the equation, there simply aren't any mechanisms in place to actually provide compensation for these people. And the Tuvaluan government is talking about possibly suing the oil companies, possibly trying to sue even the American government for not ratifying the Kyoto Protocol. But it looks like they're going to have a very tough battle on their hands to try and actually pin the liability on one single country and try and get some restitution for this. So people are suffering, and they're suffering quietly, and they're not getting any comeback at all at the moment.
Well, let's just leap from Tuvalu to something of a much greater order, namely China. And while you were there, it was in the middle of the worst drought in over a century, which affected the lives of millions of rural people.
That's right. This is the worst. It later became sort of pronounced the worst drought in recorded history. And what's interesting is that it wasn't just affecting China. It was also affecting large areas of Central Asia, even the U.S. Midwest, which is still a lot largely under drought at the moment. And this has been pointed to a sort of global teleconnection, they call it in scientific parlance, which is related to the warming of the ocean. So again, related to climate change. And so this is an issue. This is an issue which is affecting the whole of the globe. It's not just a single place, but when I went to China, I could see places where the deserts were actually shifting and expanding so rapidly that they're going over farmers' fields, and you can actually see where sand dunes are just going over pastures. And secondly, there's whole villages which have been left depopulated because people can no longer survive in them. And there was one village in particular that I visited in Inner Mongolia, and there was just one woman left in it and 300 houses. And she said that her husband had gone away to try and find work. She had no way to barely even to feed herself. And again, as I say, this is what I mean about the crisis of global warming happening quietly. There's no news photographers come to visit this woman and say, how do you feel about it? It's all something which is going on really, really out of the sight of the world's media. And incidentally, when we'd left that village, we saw this huge dust cloud come sort of roaring across the plain towards us. And within just minutes, we were engulfed in this rather terrifying dust storm. And these are also getting more frequent, and they are actually a natural catastrophe. Well, an unnatural, if you count them as global warming, but they're a catastrophe for the people who suffer in them. Sometimes dozens of people get killed because they're caught outside in these dust storms. And so it really was an incredible event.
Very, very insidious. Let's just hear from Donna in Erie, Pennsylvania. She's got her own experience of the impact of global warming.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm really taken back. I was born and raised in northwestern Pennsylvania, and when I was a kid growing up here, you never heard of tornadoes, and once every month or so you'd get a thunderstorm. And suddenly, we have been inundated by thunderstorms. I'm talking 2, 3, 4 times a week, and downpours to where it's virtually impossible to even deal with the groundwater. We have flooding in places that have never seen that kind of high water before. And adding to it, we've had rashes of tornadoes.
Do you make the connection, Donna, between what's happening there in Pennsylvania and what it is that Mark Linus is talking about, this impact of global warming in more remote areas of the world?
It seems like there's just a change in weather patterns. And until I was listening to the show just now, I didn't make that quantum leap, and that not being a person that well-versed in those sciences, I don't understand how it could be working that way. But it seems to me that, yeah, there are some real serious changes going on here.
And were you surprised at what Mark had to say about the possibility of people losing their livelihoods? And indeed, in the case of Tuvalu, the very land on which they live because of this.
It's astounding, and it's astounding that our news media spends more time covering political issues than it would ever dream of actually bringing this sort of a human story to the public's attention. I think that, you know, our government in the United States is to a great extent at fault. I mean, we have fought against the global warming theorists, not we, but the politicians, per se, for so long, and actually tried to have our excess pollution purchased by other countries. You know, it's just insane. We all live here. There's no place else to go.
Mark Linus, we'll get onto the politics and the science of it in a moment. But Donna made that point that this kind of slow motion weather change, if you like, dramatic though that it can sometimes be, is not considered newsworthy.
Well, that's certainly true. And as I say, what people are good at responding to, it's crises. It's things that happen from one day or one week to the next. It's disasters. The problem with global warming is that by the time the disasters actually happen, it's going to be too late to actually deal with the causes of them in terms of the greenhouse gas accumulation in the atmosphere. So it is quite difficult to respond to these kinds of issues, but the disasters are beginning to happen in a way which is visible enough for us to hopefully start to respond at this early stage. And that's really what I'm aiming to try and point out with the book.
Just tell me briefly about Peru, and you were able to do a compare and contrast there with the erosion of the glaciers.
Yes, this for me was a very personal journey because I grew up in Peru, and my father was working there as a geologist in the early 1980s. And we have a sort of family habit at Christmas time of looking at these old photos that he took when he was working on these geological field trips. And there are some fantastic pictures of glaciers up there. And these are 6,000-meter peaks. They have the largest area of glacier mass in the tropics anywhere in the world. So really incredible mountains. And there was one in particular which caught my eye in a valley on the east of the Cordillera Blanca in Peru called Jacabamba. And I wanted to go back to this particular glacier because I knew where it was going to be and see what had changed. And so I went up there. You know, it was a very long trek. It's an extremely remote place, and armed with this picture. And back in 1980, it was this very big fan-shaped glacier, probably about half a kilometer high, really huge and very much dominating the valley. And when I came back to the same place in 2003, the entire glacier had disappeared. It hadn't just retreated. It had been wiped off the face of the earth. And I could hardly recognize the place. All that there was left was just rock and rubble, and the lake was expanded from meltwater. But really, I was almost left without words to describe that because it was such a dramatic change. And the, you know, considering that this ice had probably been there since the last ice age, so for several thousand years, to see it disappear within a single generation of my own family was perhaps the thing that struck me most.
Let's take a call from Pete in New York City. And Pete, I understand you want to comment about the heat wave that left so many people dead in France last year.
10,000 people dead. The seniors who died in France, they ultimately estimated it at 10,000. And I've always wondered why the press hasn't commented that as the first major catastrophe in climate change.
Mark Linus?
Yeah, I can actually talk to you a little bit about that. It's 10,000, probably 14,000 in France. Across the whole of Europe, it's more like 25,000. People also died in Portugal, Spain, Germany, and even in Britain, because what we saw, and it's interesting how it wasn't seen as a climate change disaster at the time, what we saw was that temperatures were just way above the normal. They were way off the map. And the scientists looked at the statistics of what the normal climatology pattern should look like for Europe, and they saw that this was a 1 in 100,000-year event. So statistically speaking, it's almost impossible in a normal climate to get a summer that hot in Europe. And what really struck home was that these are the kinds of impacts of global warming you'd be expecting in 2050, according to the computer models, and yet it's happening already in 2003. And so I think this did begin to wake people up, because now at last you had the scientists saying, OK, rather than always saying you can't put global warming on a single event, we are saying that these incredibly high temperatures are related to global warming. The jury's not really out about that. We are increasingly worried ourselves, and we want the politicians and the public to wake up and realise it.
But despite what happened in France last year, were there still attempts to repudiate it, to try to say that it wasn't global warming or climate change?
Well, it just wasn't really discussed. In France, of course, there was a big scandal, but the scandal wasn't so much that global warming had been allowed to accelerate out of control. It was more to do with how the old people were left to die in their homes and how the politicians had been on holiday at the time. And so it's always sort of the mundane or the very direct political repercussions of these things which dominate the discussion. And there was very little fallout. And, of course, people have very short memories, so this was forgotten about within weeks of the event. And so it does make you wonder just how bad the disasters have to get before people really sit up and take notice.
Let's take a quick call from Dan in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Dan.
Hi. I have a great interest in this subject and have been following it for several years, but I've been disappointed that the discussion to this point hasn't really taken into consideration any natural phenomenon that have been demonstrated over history as yeah, I mean, we've had several ice ages. We've had environmental changes that have wiped out populations of animals. And so while I'm very willing to agree and express a concern that we have global warming, I don't know how to differentiate between that and the more or less natural processes of what the Earth has gone through for billions of years.
Let's take a quick comment, reaction there from Mark Line. It's very quick, Mark. Man-made or natural?
Well, your caller raises a very interesting point there. And the reason why scientists have a consensus that the global warming we're seeing at the moment is unnatural, i.e. human-induced, is that there aren't any mechanisms to explain it other than the fact that we've got greenhouse gas levels which are higher than they have been for millions of years. And, of course, we know that the climate fluctuates. Your caller's quite right to raise that. And it has done in the past during ice ages because of changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And that's something which is not happening at the moment. The only explanation, as I say, is greenhouse gases. So it's not as if there's any real sort of dispute about why this is going on. We know why climate's changed in the past, and we know that that's not what explains why climate is changing now.
OK, Mark Linus, stay with us. We're talking about the effects of global warming around the world, from the Peruvian mountains to the Alaskan tundra, with journalist and author Mark Linus. His new book is High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis. When you hear Mark Linus' stories, what does it make you think about the environmental policies of America, of Europe and the rest of the world? Is it time for the developing world to wake up before it's too late? Or is it is climate change rather an inevitable, unstoppable force? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the effects of global warming with journalist and author Mark Lynas. His new book is High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis. When you hear about rising sea levels and disappearing glaciers, do you feel it's time for something to be done? If so, what do you see hope for new, better environmental policies to address the effects of climate change? Is there a path ahead beyond the bitter debates and failed Kyoto Protocol? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark Lynas, in the course of your travels, Alaska, Peru, China, the Pacific Islands, those you spoke to whose lives have been so profoundly affected by extreme weather and climatic events, who did they blame?
Well, people really do tend to blame the rich countries for causing the problem, and they're quite right in doing that. And there were particularly strong words about America, in fact, to be had from the Pacific Islanders in Tuvalu. But they also blamed Australia because, of course, the Australian government has now lined up with the Bush administration and said that they won't ratify the Kyoto Protocol. And they've also made extremely sceptical statements about climate change in terms of...
And the Pacific Islanders knew all about that, did they?
They did, because Australia is their nearest, biggest and most dominating neighbour. But they also, I mean, the issue of the Bush administration's approach to global warming has made headlines right around the world. You really won't find anybody except in the most remote communities who doesn't know what America's role is in this. So I think it's generated a huge amount of bad feeling and done a lot to undermine America's image abroad, which is one of the criticisms which is often levelled at the Bush administration. And it certainly is justified in this case because they have taken an extremely undermining and obstructive role internationally. So the people who raise these concerns are quite right to raise them, and it doesn't look like anything's going to change very quickly because the administration isn't changing its tune on this.
Okay, well, it obviously then leads to the question, what's to be done? And we got a suggestion here from Jack, who's calling from Wyckoff in New Jersey. Jack, what did you want to say?
Yes, good evening, and thank you for taking my call. I understand that there are some companies and corporations that have been taking an active lead in attempting to reduce their own carbon dioxide emissions in order to assist in this global warming problem. I know, for example, or I've read that British Petroleum had instituted a program to reduce their emissions worldwide from their various facilities, and not only did they do so, but they did it earlier than they had anticipated under their own programs. If a corporation as large as BP is able to reduce its own emissions without significantly affecting its bottom line, as a matter of fact, they said that it even helped, why can't other corporations do the same thing? What is so difficult in taking a proactive role in attempting to reduce carbon dioxide emissions if it can be done without significantly affecting their businesses?
Mark Lynas?
Well, it's interesting. In fact, Jack raises a good point there. The head of BP, Lord Brown, has recently, actually only this week, written in Foreign Affairs precisely about this and what to do about global warming, given that Kyoto doesn't seem to be being implemented. And this has been backed up, of course, even by the head of Shell. So there is almost a split in the oil industry on this, because Lee Raymond, who's the head of Exxon, has gone on the record many times actually doubting the so-called theory of global warming. And, of course, Exxon Mobil has pumped lots of money into some of the extreme right-wing foundations who spend a lot of time spreading propaganda which claims that climate change is some kind of conspiracy by green extremists. So the oil industry is not united on this. It's interesting and it's positive that BP has made efforts to reduce its own emissions. But actually, in some ways, this is misleading, because the biggest impact that BP has on the environment and on global warming is through its own products, not its corporate emissions, but through the product of oil and gas that it's producing. And so it's really a drop in the ocean, the changes that it's made at a corporate level. And seeing the head of BP writing about how terrible global warming is makes you wonder quite why they're in the business that they are and whether they have any plans to shift all of their energy development into renewables like wind and solar, because you hear all the time about BP sinking new wells in order to get more oil out of the ground.
Mark Kleiner, so realistically, are governments ever going to do anything? Are individuals ever going to do anything until they see the kinds of effect that global warming, climate change is having on their own lives, as you have witnessed in Alaska, Peru, China, the Pacific Islands?
Well, and also here in America, because, of course, you've taken several calls already from people who've noticed changes in their own backyards. The issue of hurricanes, if they're getting stronger, and that's going to be infecting people to the tune of many billions of dollars of catastrophic property damages, and also people lose their lives in quite large numbers with storms like that. So it is very much a real concern. But yes, international action has been lacking. And I think this is a reflection, perhaps, of how the global warming debate has failed to make an impact at the political level. It simply isn't an issue in elections, for example, even in Europe, where it has perhaps been more widely discussed than here in the US. But it just isn't something that people are voting about. It isn't even something that people are out in the streets demonstrating about, or it hasn't been up until the last few months. And I think things are beginning to change now, that global warming has a kind of street-level currency and is becoming almost fashionable to talk about, rather than something which is shrouded in almost a conspiracy of silence.
So what's to be done? What has happened so far, the kinds of impact that you've seen on climate change, global warming in your travels, is it reversible?
No, it's not reversible. And this is perhaps the saddest aspect of what you're seeing, is that it's not only is it not reversible, but it's going to get worse before it gets better. Even if we were to stop all greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, Tuvalu would probably still be submerged. And we'd also lose the world's coral reefs and a large portion of the world's glaciers, simply because the inertia of the Earth's climate system has such a long time lag attached to it. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And we should try, particularly because the really catastrophic mass extinction and collapse of human civilization type scenarios, which have been discussed more recently, these kinds of impacts are still avoidable. And that's what we've got to set our sights on. And we need to have international political level negotiations to actually, I think, form a treaty which can start to bring greenhouse gas emissions down within the next 10 years, because really the window of opportunity is closing that rapidly.
And what's more convincing, do you think, the catastrophic warnings or the kinds of stories that you are telling, the individual stories?
Well, the catastrophic warnings are still largely in the future. The individual stories that I'm talking about are in the present, and they're really meant to be sort of almost like the canary in the coal mine. They're meant to warn of the catastrophic impacts. Of course, it's already catastrophic if you're losing your home, but this is happening still at a relatively localized level. The World Health Organization says that about 150,000 people die every year as a result of global warming-related diseases and so on. So it is affecting people in quite an incipient way. But the greatest damage is still down the line, and we've got to focus on avoiding that at the moment.
Mark, many thanks for being with us. That was Mark Lynas. His new book is High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis. We were discussing the effects of global warming with him. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, taking exception to the phrase war on terror. This is On Point. New Washington Post ABC News poll shows that President Bush is losing support on the war on terror. Since April, approval for the president's handling of terrorism has dropped 13 points, putting him about even with Democratic rival John Kerry on the issue that has defined Bush's presidency. To Boston University Professor of International Relations Andrew Bacevich, even calling the battle against terrorism a war is a misnomer. He says that real wars entail sacrifice and upheaval. In this radio diary, Andrew Bacevich argues that the war on terrorism is a war in name only.
According to President Bush, the global war on terror
is the central event of our time, comparable to what the president has called the great struggles of the last century. As prior generations confronted the challenges of Nazism and Stalinism, so destiny summons the present generation to defeat global terror. This has become America's mission, in Bush's words, to defend the peace through the forward march of freedom. Yet peeling back the rhetoric reveals a different story. By historical standards, the enterprise that some have described as another world war has turned out to be a niggling affair. Bush has asked nothing and required nothing of Americans, and nothing pretty much describes what we've anteed up to support the cause. With the third anniversary of the global war on terror fast approaching, the administration has not expanded the armed forces and apparently has no plans to do so. It categorically rejects proposals to revive the draft. It has left untouched the rituals of consumption deemed essential to the American economy. It has studiously refrained from curtailing corporate profits or corporate prerogatives. Old-timers will recall when big wars meant rationing and higher taxes. Not this time. Through deficit spending, we will slough off the cost of war onto future generations. Thus, for most Americans, the global war on terror has become a little like global warming. We sense dimly that we ought to take it seriously, but in practice, we go about our daily routine as if it didn't exist. Pass through a major airport, visit a mall or supermarket, shop for a new car, and look for signs that this nation is engaged in anything approximating a great struggle. There are none, which suits Bush just fine. Real wars, those that engage the passions of the American people, energize politics and subvert the established order. Change is the last thing that this administration wants. For despite the high-sounding talk, the overriding aim of this war is not to march toward freedom, but to dissuade Americans from peering too deeply at the events of 9/11. Were they to do so, they just might pose discomforting questions about the competence of our leaders, the organization and purposes of government, the premises of U.S. foreign policy, and the scorecard showing who wins and who loses in American society. The contrast with World War II is instructive. To fight that war, Franklin D. Roosevelt mobilized the nation. The result was decisive victory. But with victory came other, largely unanticipated consequences. Roosevelt's crusade to liberate enslaved nations raised questions about the meaning of freedom at home. As such, it gave impetus to the embryonic civil rights movement. It undermined old notions of a woman's place. It affirmed workers' rights to organize and bargain collectively. It extinguished old forms of religious bigotry targeting Catholics and Jews. It created a new class of politically aware and upwardly mobile citizens, the 16 million returning veterans. Not all of the war's effects were benign. Japanese Americans were sent to concentration camps. Economic mobilization and urban overcrowding produced profiteering, crime, social dislocation, and race riots. But overall, World War II reinvigorated American democracy. Small wonder that for those who fought it, the war remained thereafter the central event of their lives. My mother is an 81-year-old veteran. After graduating from high school in 1941, she became an Army nurse, serving in Saipan and Tinian. Her military service remains the pivot of her young adulthood. My own youngest daughter is today the same age as my mother was then. 60 years from now, will she regale her grandchildren with stories of what it was like to live through the war on terror? The question answers itself. Dedicating the National World War II Memorial last month, President Bush quoted
Colonel Ovetta Culp-Hobby, a veteran of that conflict. "This was a people's war," Colonel Hobby had remarked, "and everyone was in it." It was, and they were. But Bush's war isn't, and we the people aren't. And the difference speaks volumes about the prospects for victory and about the content of our democracy.
Andrew Bacevich is a retired Army colonel and professor of international relations at Boston University. He lives in Walpole, Massachusetts. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.